Hey everyone, and welcome back to your weekly Linux and open source news show. I'm your host Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web spaces over the course of the previous week. So in this episode, we have a proposal for Fedora to leave GNOME for KDE when Fedora 42 comes. It has very little chances of happening, and no, it is not an April Fool's joke, even though it was published on April 1st. We also have some repercussions of the giant XZ library backdoor that was detected, with a bunch of distributions scrambling, some projects reorganizing to avoid depending on such libraries, and other little things that might shake up a little bit how Linux and open source projects work. We also have a German state moving to Linux and free and open source software, including LibreOffice, for 30,000 computers. We have some nice changes to Mint 22. We have AMD open sourcing more documentation and code. We have some changes coming to Thunderbird as well. We have a distro ditching Plasma for the MAUI shell desktop, and a lot more. So as always, if you want to learn more about any of these topics, all the links that I used to make this show are in the show notes as a reference. And if you want this show to keep going without ads, well, you can keep supporting the show or start supporting it by using any of the links in the show notes as well. And if you become a Patreon member, you will get a daily version of that show as well, complete with an RSS feed, so you don't have to wait for the end of the week to get the news. So now let's begin. So first is a proposal that happened this week for Fedora 42 to move to KDE Plasma instead of GNOME in the default workstation edition. This is apparently not an April Fool's joke. It was taken as such by a lot of people, and you can understand why. Fedora has always been a GNOME-focused distribution, so having it move to KDE might seem like a joke, and it was published on April 1st, so obviously people assumed. But no, it is not an April Fool's joke. It was submitted by the lead for the Budgie desktop, Joshua Strobel. And the justification behind this proposal is that Plasma provides a more flexible experience for users. It is now stable enough with Plasma 6, it supports more standards than what GNOME actually implements, and it has way better Wayland support as a whole. They also argue that KDE has pushed for a lot more advancement to the Linux desktop than GNOME did, and same for Wayland, with a lot of various protocols being driven by KDE contributors. Another argument is that Plasma is currently used by the Steam Deck on its desktop mode. It is used as the default for Pine 64 products, and on distributions from Linux manufacturers like Tuxedo with Tuxedo OS, which incidentally is the distro I use with Plasma. Meaning that Plasma could now be more familiar to a lot of users, not taking into account that Plasma also looks way more familiar for Windows users than GNOME could do. So they propose to have the default spin of Fedora, the default workstation edition, using KDE, and to move the GNOME version to a separate spin. Joshua says that while he's the lead for an entirely different desktop, namely Budgie, he thinks that having Plasma as the default would make Fedora more appealing to people. And seeing as Fedora is a very popular distro, it would also make Linux as a whole more popular by providing a more feature-rich experience by default to more users. There's also the fact that KDE switched to a new release schedule with two major releases per year that's way more aligned with what Fedora and other distributions do, so it also makes it more suitable to be adopted as the default. Now, personally, and judging from how the conversation about this proposal is going, I don't think it has a single chance to be adopted, because Red Hat and Fedora are heavily invested in the development and progress of GNOME. And Fedora is sort of the community edition or spin and also upstream of Red Hat's desktop distros. So it could hardly move to Plasma if Red Hat Enterprise Linux doesn't plan on doing so as well. Now, some Fedora contributors pointed out that Fedora is independent on these things. They don't have such close ties with Red Hat as people think. And so they absolutely could decide to change the default desktop if they wanted to. The reasons why they probably will not is that they have a great relationship with GNOME, they like what they offer with GNOME, they like the simplicity, and they just don't want to ditch all of that and replace the default. It also looks like the topic has now been closed. The conversation around this proposal has been closed by Fedora Council members, because apparently it was submitted with the change process, which is where you can submit changes or proposal to change Fedora. But this being such a huge change would need to be discussed by a higher authority than just the community. It is the purview of Fedora Steering Committee. And so this conversation should really be handled by the Fedora Workstation Workgroup, which historically has always been in favor of GNOME. So if this proposal is submitted to them, it has virtually zero chance of ever happening. Also, the conversation started to devolve into the usual GNOME is better, no, Plasma is better, GNOME has better tech, Plasma has better tech, more people use GNOME, no more people use KDE, sort of argument that you always see when talking about these two desktop environments, so it was completely improductive. In the discussion thread, the alternative that was pushed instead of trying to completely replace GNOME with Plasma would be to promote the KDE spin that currently exists as a full workstation edition, thus making it way more official, giving it more promotion, providing a download link straight from the homepage without having to navigate to the Fedora spins. So this KDE variant would be way more visible. And honestly, I think this would be the best choice. It does introduce an additional choice for people who want to use Fedora. It does muddy the branding a little bit, but it could be a solid proposal. There is a process to do just that, but apparently this process just does not have a good shot of happening either, according to Matthew Miller, who is a Fedora Council member, because this proposal had already been done to try and create a Fedora Scientific Edition, which brought a lot of, well, tools related to scientific work, and used Plasma as the default. This proposal had been sadly rejected by the Fedora Workstation Working Group. Now, according to Matthew Miller as well, he said that if every other avenue fails and this proposal just gets ditched out of hand by every single Fedora institution, he said that the Fedora Council would give this proposal to promote the KDE spin as a full edition. They would give this proposal a fair look and a fair assessment. Now, no, this is not an April Fool joke. Some people really thought it was. It's not. And no, I don't think this will ever happen, at least not in the form it was requested. The GNOME edition of Fedora is not going anywhere. I would be absolutely flabbergasted if that happened. But promoting the KDE spin as an official edition would not be a bad idea, I think. It would give people more choice, and it would make KDE a more prominent actor on Fedora, which is not a bad thing. Now, last week, I talked, at least in the dedicated news video, this news missed the deadline to be included in this audio show, I talked about the backdoor in the very popular XZ library. To sum things up, a contributor that had been contributing to the XZ library, a compression library, for a very long time, introduced voluntarily a backdoor inside of this project that affected a bunch of distributions, thus making this library pretty undesirable. The GitHub repo was closed for a moment. I think it might still be by GitHub, because obviously it is malicious software. A bunch of distros had to roll back to a previous version, and this vulnerability, this backdoor, basically let attackers compromise your system by using SSH without any authentication. It did not affect every distro that shipped the latest versions of XZ, but it did affect a lot of them. And so with this problem identified, there are a bunch of repercussions happening. First, it pushed Canonical to delay the beta of Ubuntu 24.04 LTS. It was planned for this week on April 4th, and it will now be released next week on the 11th, because Ubuntu developers are trying to review every package that might depend on the XZ library and could have been compromised as well, and they're trying to rebuild all these packages in a brand new environment that's been set up just for that and that has not been affected by the vulnerability. Other distributions are doing that as well. For example, OpenSUSE Tumbleweeds, they were affected by that backdoor, and they're doing the same thing. They're rebuilding all the packages that were linked to the XZ library. I think it's often packaged as liblzma, so you might want to check on your system which version of that you have and check if that version could be affected by the backdoor. Debian 12.6, an update to Debian Bookworm, was also postponed because they were also affected by that exact problem. So technically, the stable, final stable release of Ubuntu 24.04 LTS should not be affected. It is still planned for release at the end of the month. I think it's April 25. And there will just be one less week for beta testing the distro. I think the delay was needed here to just make sure that you're not shipping an LTS ISO that has a backdoor in it. It really should not affect the final state of the distro to lose 1 week of testing on the beta. Ubuntu LTS are generally very well tested. They ship pretty stable packages that have already been tested as well. So there shouldn't be a problem. I think they made the right call. Another repercussion is that systemd will start to reduce its dependencies on external libraries, or at least they're looking at how they could do that, which probably systemd detractors will appreciate. They probably will want more backdoors, so systemd relies on less stuff. Now, all those dependencies would be linked to those used to build libsystemd. That's the heart of the systemd init system. And the goal is obviously to reduce the surface of attack for that very prevalent init system. And so they would like to remove all the external dependencies they can and just limit themselves to depending on libc, which obviously they need. So it's just a proposal for now, but it seems to be gaining some traction, even though it would require a big reorganization of the library's code. They would probably have to split it into multiple smaller libraries for each API that systemd provides, meaning that probably systemd would also be more modular, and so in the end might be less hated for being a monolithic block, because presumably, you could maybe ship only parts of the systemd systems without shipping the entirety of libsystemd. Some of these changes were already implemented a while back. For example, libsystemd no longer mandated the use of a compression library like what XZ was, for example. So here again, I don't think it's a bad idea. It's a good idea for security reasons, because at least you only have to worry about issues in your own code, not in external libraries that you depend upon, but also in terms of what systemd requires to work or requires to be used in a distro. If it depends on less external libraries and it re-implements the features it needs itself, chances are it will be lighter, because they don't need to install or load the entire library just to use a few features from it. They would just have just the features that they actually need, and so in the end it would probably be lighter. We're also seeing other changes linked to that same backdoor. For example, the Linux firmware update system will move from the XZ compression library to the library called ZStandard or ZSTD. It's also a compression library, but apparently it brings performance benefits, as ZSTD is apparently faster at decompressing stuff than XZ, and it has higher compression ratios. It could also save 3% more space than XZ. On top of that, the project has a lot more trust right now than XZ, obviously, because XZ is just not trusted at all at the moment. And Arch Linux also did the same thing a while back. I think it was in 2020. They moved from XZ to ZSTD for all the packages in the Arch repo. So there's a precedent for that. And as everyone is scrambling to identify and fix the issues linked to this very nasty backdoor, at least it's going to be relatively easy to identify if a project has been compromised by the same kind of stuff. There's a new scanner called Binarly, and it was created to deal with this exact issue. It will detect this specific backdoor in any file, library, or executable that might implement it. So if the malicious contributor who added this backdoor to XZ did it to another project, or if someone used the same technique in another project, we should know pretty soon. The scanner can detect the backdoor even if the code of it has been changed or has been recompiled, so it should be relatively foolproof, and you can just drop your file onto their website to analyze it, or they have a freely accessible API if you want to do bulk analysis. So at least with this exact backdoor, we should be safe for now. The tool is available on the xz.fail website. Now this obviously will not fix the root of the issue, because if malicious actors start embedding themselves in projects multiple years in advance to contribute real code that works, that is solid, and then start adding backdoors 2 or 3 years later, it is going to be pretty hard to fight this kind of embedding of malicious people. A random snippet of code that is submitted by a first-time contributor will probably be looked at very thoroughly because you don't know that person, you don't know their pedigree, you don't know how well they know code, how well they know your project, and you don't know where they're coming from. So you're going to look at their first commit a lot harder than something that's been contributed by a long-time contributor or even a maintainer. Someone that's been in the project for 2 years and has done nothing but good, solid code, you're probably just going to check the sanity of their code just to see if the feature works, if it's well implemented, if this is performant enough, but you're not going to check at security issues all that much because you kind of trust the person. So this is going to be really hard to fix and to avoid in the future, and that's really the root cause that we need to address. Detecting backdoors is fine, relying on less external libraries is fine, but we'll always need to do that. So we need to have a solid process to check who is contributing to what and verify that what they're contributing stays sane over time. Now we have some good news for Linux adoption. One of Germany's federal states, Schleswig-Holstein, decided to move from Windows and Microsoft Office to Linux and LibreOffice. And this move will transition 30,000 computers to open source software, which is really cool. Now, obviously, this is part of the recent European countries' moves for more digital sovereignty. They want to have better control over the data that is being collected by the software they use and where that data is being transferred and who can access it, if it's another government, if it's a company. They also want to try and keep control of the software that they use to not be beholden to any company or country where this company operates. It's always better if you have access to the code. You might not need to tweak it, but if at some point you need to implement a feature or you need to check how something works or you need to fork it to build your own project, you can. If you use Windows or Microsoft Office, the moment Microsoft removes a feature that you need or changes how things work, you have to accept the change. You don't have a choice. So this transition will not only concern the operating system and the Office suite, but it also encompasses pretty much the entire software ecosystem of the federal state. They will move to things like Nextcloud, like Thunderbird and OpenExchange. It will also apparently replace Microsoft Active Directories and a few other things. We don't know yet which distro they will pick or if they will make their own, and they also thought about training, apparently, to make sure that employees will be able to use and to understand and to master this new software environment and to stay productive. This is important because this has often been a big point of failure. You just transition everyone to a new system, you give them 3 days of training, and then you drop them in, expecting them to be as efficient as they were before, which is obviously a mistake because habits take a long time to be retrained. So you need to have ongoing training and accessible help and documentation and seminars and whatever so people can stay on top of what they used to know how to do and they can learn how to do it in the new software. This transition will be mandatory for all computers affected, but they're willing to take their time and grant possible exceptions if really a solution cannot be found to replace a proprietary piece of software, and so they would avoid breaking important systems. It is an absolutely fantastic move. Congrats to Schleswig-Holstein. Now, whether this move will stick, we'll have to see. It is not the first time a German state or town or city has made that transition, and they usually walked it back a few years afterwards. But it is clear, at least in my opinion, that governments and public institutions should not be using public money to pay or rent proprietary software. The same amount of money could be way better spent to improve open source software, to implement solutions that will be a better fit in the long run with more control. These kind of transitions will cost more money upfront in general than just renewing your current contract, but in the long run, they have the potential to actually save you millions if you actually manage to detach yourself from Windows and Microsoft Office and anything else that you might just pay a subscription for. For 30,000 PCs, if you don't have to pay ongoing fees or like you just hire someone to maintain the systems, it's gonna be way cheaper in the long run. In France, for example, we don't have many examples of this kind of transitions. I think our Gendarmerie Nationale, which is sort of like the police but attached to the military instead of being more of a like sort of civilian institution, I think they use a derivative of Ubuntu and they have for a while, but As far as I know, that's the only thing Linux-related that we use for most of our systems. So, congrats Germany, well, at least congrats for this federal state. It's a good move, I think. And still on Germany, they scored another win. Well, another potential win, because they are now seeking to make encryption a legal right. Certain digital services in Germany might even have to implement end-to-end encryption if the law is passed, meaning that messaging platforms, email solutions or providers, and cloud service providers would be required to encrypt their data whenever it is technically possible. This new bill is an amendment to the German Data Protection Act, and it would also force companies to explain users how to use this encryption and how to set it up in case it is not enabled by default. For example, if you use an iPhone, you might not know that all your iCloud data can be encrypted straight from your iPhone, but Apple never tells you this because if you do so, then they cannot really pilfer your information to sell you more apps and more services inside of your iPhone through ads for Apple services and apps. But you can do that. With this kind of law, they would be forced to probably offer you the choice when you set up your phone if you want to encrypt things or not. So that's pretty cool. The cybersecurity community seems really thrilled with this, of course, although the law still needs to be voted on by the German parliament, and there are apparently some points that need to be cleared up, because in some cases, it looks like the users might have to implement encryption themselves or to set it up on their own, and also where the exception is laid out. Like, they say companies would be required to encrypt their data whenever it is technically possible. There are basically no details on what would make it technically impossible to do so. So as always, with every law, there need to be like some precisions and amendments to it, but it is a good signal to send to companies. You just cannot keep transferring sensitive data or user data unencrypted, where it can be intercepted and read by malicious actors, governments, and other actors. And end-to-end encryption is just not the end-all be-all of cybersecurity. If you want better privacy, you also need zero-access encryption, meaning that the provider of the service just cannot decrypt your data themselves. But it is still a pretty nice thing that Germany is trying to do here. Now this week we also got some news about Linux Mint 22, the future release of the relatively popular distribution, and it looks like they're going to be making some interesting changes. So first, the distribution, as virtually every other major distro, will move to Pipewire as its main sound server. This thing is now really solid compared to the alternatives, so it makes sense. The new version of Mint will also undo Ubuntu's recent change to distribute Thunderbird as a snap by default. Mint has historically really not liked snaps. They uproot snapd, they replace every snap package that Ubuntu defaults to with deb packages that they build themselves, and they will do exactly that for Thunderbird as well, just like what they did with Firefox when Ubuntu decided to ship that as a snap as well. Mint 22 will also bring two new applications, one being called Juggernaut. It's a new IRC client that isn't really an IRC client. It's more dedicated for user support because Mint uses IRC to provide potential user support if someone needs it. But the old client, Hexchat, was just too busy. I think it was unmaintained as well. So they rebuilt a new interface that is really more dedicated for user support. It's not meant for general IRC use. They're also bringing a new app, which is GNOME Online Accounts GTK. It's a fork of GNOME's Online Accounts module that can be used by Mint's GTK 3 or GTK 4 applications instead of being locked in to GNOME settings. That's not all though, because Mint 22 will also start changing how they distribute kernel updates. Previously on Linux Mint, you were pretty much stuck to the default kernel your distro got shipped with. You only got security updates. And if you wanted to support more hardware, or if you wanted more recent kernel drivers, you could manually add the LTS kernels that Ubuntu create with the hardware enablement stack, meaning that it did support more recent hardware, but it stayed on the older base. Now, these hardware enablement stack kernels will be automatically shipped to every user by default and built into the ISOs that Mint distributes, meaning that every Mint user will use the same kernel and the distro will remain installable on recent hardware as hardware progresses and Mint versions age a little bit. You won't need an Edge ISO like what they started providing early this year. But of course, it's Mint, so if you prefer using the LTS kernel without all that extra hardware support, you will be able to do so. Basically, they are reverting the process. Instead of being stuck on the older kernel and having to manually enable the new one, now you will be able to automatically have the new one and manually enable the older one if you prefer. So it is, all in all, a continuation of Mint's trajectory. They keep to Ubuntu as a base. They are still not announcing any move to Linux Mint Debian Edition as the default, although I don't really understand why, because they really do not like what Ubuntu is doing on their desktop, notably the support for snaps. And it doesn't just affect the desktop, it affects the core of Ubuntu. At some point, if Ubuntu decides to ship more components with just Snap, for example, if they decided to make their Ubuntu Core Desktop Edition, their immutable distro, if they decided to make that the default, then Mint would really have to move to something else. And Mint is also trying to avoid a transition to GTK4, or at least to the GNOME tools that they still have that use GTK4 and libadvisa, because they don't want to use that thing either. I personally think that the last point, trying to fight against libadvisa and GNOME apps, is fighting against the tide. The only solution that they really have is to uproot everything GNOME related and just either build their own tools or fork them, just like they've done it with GNOME online accounts. I think in the near future, Mint will have to make a decision. They're not really based on GNOME anymore for Cinnamon. They do use some GTK and GNOME technologies, but they're really moved into their own thing. But for their Ubuntu base, they're gonna have to make a decision. I don't think they're gonna keep supporting this Ubuntu base for super long, because it probably adds them a ton of work to uproot a lot of the Ubuntu systems that they don't like and replace them by stuff that they actually like. So at some point, maybe moving to the Debian base might be a better option, but for now, that's not what they're doing. Early this week, AMD teased that they were going to open source more portions of the code related to their hardware, notably probably for firmware stuff, and also more hardware documentation. People assumed it was for ROCm, but apparently it wasn't. They're going to open source the code for their Micro Engine Scheduler. That's a microcontroller that has been added to AMD GPUs a while back. I think it was in 2006 or 2007. And this is a little microcontroller that supports scheduling the processes and tasks on the GPU, presumably to affect each task to the relevant core, much like a CPU has. For example, Intel has a microcontroller as well on their CPUs. AMD has one as well. It's basically the same thing. It's probably the equivalent of the GSP, the GPU system processor, on NVIDIA GPUs. So this thing has proprietary firmware for now, but AMD will release documentation for that thing at the end of May, and after that they will release the source code for the firmware as well. So this is a great move. It will make testing and debugging and improving AMD drivers on Linux a lot easier. And there are apparently, according to Foronix, other parts of AMD GPUs that are still closed source and aren't covered by that new open source code and documentation, but it is still a very nice step forward. And you really have to appreciate AMD's open source efforts. They are not perfect, no hardware manufacturer really is, but they're definitely one of the best when it comes to that kind of stuff. So props to them, and let's hope this trend continues, and let's hope other manufacturers take note as well, for example, NVIDIA. Now, we also have some news about the Thunderbird project. They apparently are making good progress on the addition of Exchange support natively inside of Thunderbird. They've now implemented Exchange auto-discovery, meaning that if you enter an email address that is linked to an Exchange server, it will be able to automatically detect the parameters of that server to configure how to connect to it. They also have the OAuth compatibility in the account setup, meaning that you'll be able to log in correctly on your Exchange app, and it will be able to open a web browser window for you to log in and pass that login back to Thunderbird. All the folders can also now be fetched and displayed in the folders list of Thunderbird as well, and these features will be added as an opt-in in the next beta release. So if you want to test it out with your Exchange server, you can, and people who aren't interested will not be polluted by a non-complete feature. Now, for non-exchange users, there was also work on better handling mailing list subscriptions. There's also a transition to JavaScript modules to improve the state of the code base. And the other areas of focus for the month are finishing the revamp of the Cards View user interface for email, improving the quick filters bar, and improving the API for add-ons. So it's really cool to see Thunderbird moving forward. It's already really awesome to use right now. I moved to it and I said it before, they even sponsored this podcast at some point. I still have a few issues with Thunderbird, notably with search. I think the default unified search is pretty bad. It's hard to find what you're looking for. It's not a suitable view for email, so I always have to move back to the cards view for email. I don't think it works super well, especially for someone like me who just lumps everything into one archive folder and tries to use search to find what they're looking for. But the rest of the app is really cool, and they have a really solid plan to evolve it in the future, so I really enjoy using it. And also, the Thunderbird team will now take control of their Snap package as well. Canonical had been creating and maintaining that Snap package themselves for all of its existence, and since it will now be the default format used for Thunderbird in 24.04, Ubuntu will no longer ship it as a deb, they will ship it as a Snap, even inside the ISO. So the Thunderbird team decided that they'd better make sure that this package was up to the task. So officially now, they will support the Flatpak package, which they took ownership a while back, and the Snap package as well. And that Snap package has been added to their build infrastructure to make sure that everything is always nice and up to date. So whenever a new version is pushed to the Thunderbird Snap GitHub repo, the existing launchpad mirror that Ubuntu used to make the Snap package will grab that new version, it will automatically build the Snap, and if that build is successful, this updated Snap will be published to its relevant Snap channel, whether if it's a beta version, a stable version, an edge version, or whatever else. All the bugs will now have to be reported in the main Bugzilla instance of the Thunderbird project, not on the Thunderbird Snap GitHub repo. And, I mean, why not? A lot of Ubuntu users will have that Snap package as the default with 24.04, so Thunderbird might as well take control of that package. Now, if you watched the latest video I published on the channel, I think it was on Thursday, you will notice that in a survey that I did, most people just do not use snaps at all. I think it was 84% of the 9,500 answers that I got who said they do not use snap packages at all, compared to about 72% of people who said that they did use Flatpaks. So people really prefer Flatpaks than snaps. It is absolutely a thing, at least in my community. But Snap packages still exist. They're still being pushed by Ubuntu. They don't seem to want to back down from that format. They want to keep pushing it. So if it has to be used, I think Thunderbird made the right call here. Taking control of that package is much better. They could have decided to just leave it as an unofficial effort. The problem is, most people would assume that any problem with that Snap package was a Thunderbird problem, and the image of the project would have been tarnished even though it wasn't their fault. So at least by taking ownership of this thing, they can make sure it works just as they intended to, and they can really take the blame if anything goes wrong, instead of being forced to take it for something they didn't create themselves. Now, you might have heard of Nitrux, or maybe even you use it. Maybe it's Nitrux, it's Nitrux. It's a Debian-based app image-focused distro that defaults to Plasma as its desktop environment. They just released a new version, version 3.4, and it is still based on Plasma 5.27. They actually stopped using packages from KDE Neon to build and distribute their desktop environment, which is KDE. Instead, they defaulted to Debian's packages. And the reason is they're not going to be moving to Plasma 6. They will stick to 5.27 until the end of the year. And after that, they will move to MAUI Shell, which is a relatively recent and relatively unknown new desktop built by the MAUI project. I report on the MAUI project efforts whenever I can or whenever there's something good or that looks nice. It's a project that builds a ton of applications that work really well on mobile, but also work on desktop. They really are more of a KDE Plasma mobile effort, as far as I understand. They do use the KDE frameworks and Kirigami, I think, as a base. But they are not super well known in the desktop space. And they also do build their MAUI shell, which is a basically a shell, a desktop, to run all of these apps on. The main reason that Nitrux will be moving to that is that their NX desktop customization layer, something that they tack on top of KDE to make the desktop look like what they want it to look, this thing is apparently incompatible with Plasma 6. All their extra widgets and plasmoids would have to be rewritten for Plasma 6. And since MAUI Shell is apparently shaping up nicely, they would rather move to that. They will still use a lot of KDE technologies, including KDE frameworks, but they won't use Plasma anymore. Now, the MAUI desktop, I don't really know about. I haven't tried it yet, because on their progress reports, they always report about building up the frameworks, moving to Qt 6, improving the apps, but the MAUI shell we rarely hear about or see how it looks like, so it doesn't seem to make super fast progress, or at least their reports don't really showcase that progress. So I just cannot say how far along this MAUI shell thing is from being a daily usable thing. I will definitely try it out when Nitrux makes the move, just to see how it works. The weird thing to me is that they say they will need to do a lot of work to port their widgets to Plasma 6, and so instead they will give themselves what seems like a lot more work to transition their entire desktop to something else. I'm not sure I understand the rationale here, unless what they added to Plasma is absolutely impossible to accomplish in Plasma 6, which would feel very surprising to me because they did say widgets would have to be rewritten to work well with Plasma 6, but also they didn't say they were removing any API or access to anything, so I don't know. I guess I will wait for the next release of Nitrux and try it out. It will give me a solid base to try out the MAUI shell, which I've been talking about for a while but never really had the chance to try. Okay, and to conclude on this episode, we have to talk about Linux gaming a little bit, and just a little bit. It's still clawing its way back up to almost 2% of the Steam market share, 1.94% in March exactly, after it dropped in February. Of course, it is still all completely propped up by the Steam Deck, with 44% of the Linux market share on Steam being from a Steam Deck, meaning that almost half of people who actually participate in the Steam survey run Steam Decks and don't necessarily have another Linux gaming computer. AMD CPUs still represent 72% of Linux users, where on Windows it's the opposite, where Intel grabs 68% of the market. Interestingly, on the little survey that I did, and for which I published a video on Thursday, most people seem to be either or. I think Intel was 49% and AMD was 50% out of 9,500 answers. So really, people who game on Linux have different computers than the general Linux community. Now, Linux is still significantly higher in this Steam survey than macOS. This one sits at 1.38%. But of course, Windows is still just erasing everything else at 96.67%. So we are still a very niche market for gaming, and we will probably remain that way for a very long while, because Linux gaming is a thing. It is doable, it works really well, the Steam Deck proves it, virtually every single player title can now be played really well through Proton, but there are still problems, notably with anti-cheat solutions. They are the bane of the Linux gaming experience. And so right now, when you say, hey, you should move to Linux for gaming, we're not really offering a better experience than people who already are on Windows. We're just selling Linux gaming on the fact that it can run most of your games. So unless the user really has enough beef with Windows that changing their entire OS would be a suitable solution, it is hard to convert people. Telling people, hey, you could get an almost as good experience if you switch to Linux, is not necessarily a fantastic argument in favor of Linux gaming. Now, don't get me wrong, I've been gaming on Linux exclusively for the past 6 years, at least when it comes to PCs. I do own a console, but all my gaming happens mostly on my gaming console running Linux and on my main computer running Linux as well for strategy games when I don't want to use a controller. So obviously I am absolutely for Linux gaming, I think it's fantastic, but if you're talking to someone who plays a lot of multiplayer titles and always wants the latest AAA multiplayer competitive experience, then telling them maybe your game will run and maybe the next one won't is not really a suitable argument to convert them. So we need to get this anti-cheat thing sorted out, and once that's done, maybe we'll be a perfect solution for all gamers. Right now, we're not. Not really for everyone, at least. Okay, so this will conclude this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, you can find all the links that I used to create this show in the show notes. And as always, if you want to support the podcast and you like it, there are links in the show notes as well to do just that. If you become a Patreon member, you will get daily versions of this show if you want news that isn't a week old. So, thank you all for listening, and I guess you will hear me in the next one next week. Bye!